last time about the battle here that Gideon waged against the Midianites, and as we suggested then, I think it'd be hard for us to overstate how significant this Midianite threat was. And just to remind you, this tribal group that was on the Transjordan side down south, making their way up the Transjordan, raiding the Israelite territory, and finally crossing the Jordan River at the Jezreel Valley and beginning their raids here in the land of Canaan and going all through the land of Canaan during harvest time. It was just a tremendous threat. And so as we talked about last time, Judges 6 and 7, discussing how God used Gideon and a force of 300 men to have a marvelous victory against the Midianites. Here in the Jezreel Valley, just on the north side of Mount Gilboa, and really between Mount Tabor and Mount Gilboa, and routing that Midianite army, routing them to the point where they fled back across the Jordan River. Those who had survived the battle, the Midianites fled across the Jordan River, and were running back down south, trying to obviously to get back to their territory, to get outside of Israelite territory. And so the Israelite forces led by Gideon are now chasing them and trying to ultimately capture all of the remaining Midianite kings. So that's what's happening here at the end of chapter 7 and as we begin chapter 8. And I did want to just note something here that happens here at the end of chapter 7. Gideon elicits the help of the tribe of Ephraim at this point, because the Midianites have fled so far down south to the Jabbok River, where this area right here is where there was a ford where you could cross the Jordan River. Near the city of Adam. That was a little village just right there at that ford. And so what Gideon does is he calls for the men of Ephraim to cross that ford and to capture the remaining Midianite kings and those who had fled that far south. Sort of to, we might say, cut them off at the pass, as Gideon is pursuing from the north and the men of Ephraim actually capture and kill the Midianite kings, or two of them. And so that's what happens at the end of chapter 7. Now, I say all that because that's what sets up some things that occur in chapter 8. Before we go into chapter 8, any questions or comments about anything in the last two chapters that we didn't have a chance to get to? Yeah, Jack. I don't really know that the text gives us much of an indication, but I really think that we're talking about just a few weeks here. I don't think we're talking about some great period of time. Does that help? Yeah, of course. Well, yeah, but keep in mind, this is a very small territory. Remember, Palestine is really very, very tiny. So, you know, it just takes, you know, maybe three or four days walking to traverse the entire length of the territory, you know. So I don't really get the impression that we're talking here about just any larger period of time than maybe weeks here. Other comments or questions about anything in chapter 6 and 7? Okay. What I want us to do here, let me just skip that slide. As we get into chapter 8, it seems to me that what you have here are several things that address the issue of Gideon's leadership. And obviously, when you think about Gideon as a leader, as a warrior, he, of course, excels here. Yahweh is obviously working with him. but he leads them in a great victory. But as we get to chapter 8, I want you just to think about some of the things that are said about Gideon and his leadership. And I think most of these things are outstanding. But as we think about all that happens, I want you just to ask the question, what does this indicate about Gideon's leadership? So let's go ahead and just look at this. In the first three verses of chapter 8, you have a very interesting issue that arises with the men of Ephraim. And I want us just to look at this. Then the men of Ephraim said to him, "What is this thing you have done to us by not calling us when you went to fight against Midian?" And they contended with him vigorously. But he said to them, "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer? God has given the leaders of Midian, Oreb and Zeeb, into your hands. And what was I able to do in comparison with you?" Then their anger toward him subsided when he said that. That's kind of an interesting little account, isn't it? What are the men from Ephraim upset about initially? Yeah, now we just talked about how he had asked them to cut off the fleeing Midianites there at the ford at the Jabbok River, which they did. So what do they mean when they say, "You didn't ask us to come and fight the Midianites"? From the very beginning, you didn't call upon us to assist you in this tremendous battle that you had, this great victory where 300 Israelites were able to rout this Midianite army. And just think about the prestige of that victory and, you know, overwhelming odds and all this. And don't you know, in the days and weeks after that everybody was talking about that wonderful victory. And the men of Ephraim are saying, "Hey, you didn't call us to participate in that battle." Well, what does Gideon say in response to that? He does pacify them. But what does he say to do that? He points out, look what you have done, and in comparison with what you have done, what I and the 300 did is nothing. Now, what had the men of Ephraim done when they finally were called into the fray? What? Well, they at least captured, captured and killed those who were fleeing southward, but especially what does Gideon point out that they did in the midst of that? Two of the Midianite kings. Remember, this is a tribal group. So you have various leaders or kings of the Midianite tribes. And the men of Ephraim captured two of those kings. And look at how Gideon characterizes then these events. He says, "You are the ones responsible for getting these two leaders of the Midianites. We just conquered a bunch of soldiers. You got the kings." So who had the more notable part to play in this whole battle? You did, not us. What do you think about that? What does that say to you about Gideon as a leader? Pretty good psychology. Was it true? Was it a valid point? Well, yeah. Now, is that the way they had been looking at it? No, it's all in how you perceive things. But up to this point, who had been getting all the credit and all the glory? Gideon and the 300 men. But he's willing, in order to placate the men of Ephraim, he's willing to give them all this glory and honor and say, "Listen, you did something far more noble than we accomplished." It's good psychology. And does it not show some humility on his part? Seems to me it does. So I think that's interesting. Here's a man who, as a leader, is not only having to lead in battle, but you know, he's having to work with egos and feelings and all that kind of stuff, and that can be very, very difficult. But he has humility enough to go ahead and pacify them and make sure everything is fine and get them to look at this in a different way that will maybe salvage their ego a little bit. To me, that's interesting. Mickey?
Well, he did that, but he didn't the way God's just do. Because he declared that God give them to kings.
Right. Exactly.
You can't denounce that because that's very important.
Absolutely. That's an excellent point. The ultimate conqueror here is Yahweh, and he makes that very, very clear. In fact, I want us to come back to that issue because it's going to be very important in what we're going to look at next. Any other comment about this incident where he placates the Ephraimites? Why do you think maybe especially the men of Ephraim might have really got their feelings hurt that they had not been called into battle initially? Maybe a point we ought to add here. Who's the leading tribe of Israel during this period of time before the monarchy? Ephraim. Remember, Ephraim is a Joseph tribe, one of the two Joseph tribes. And Ephraim is even of Ephraim and Manasseh. Ephraim is the leading Joseph tribe. It's only when David is anointed to the kingship that the tribe of Judah ever is elevated to a place of prominence in the nation and its leadership. That's the first time that will happen. So really all during this judge's era, Ephraim is the more leading tribe. They had the best territory by lot. You know, that's how the lot fell. And their territory of Ephraim is much more fertile. And they're just things like that. So, that may be part of why they, you know, kind of wearing their feelings on their togas, maybe. That was a poor joke that I'm just going to go right on by and forget I said that. Okay, what I want us to now look at is verses 4 through 17. I'm not going to take time to read all these verses, but I trust that you've already read through this chapter. He punishes the disloyalty of the Israelites at Succoth and Penuel. And I want us just to look at not all these verses, but just look at a little bit of it so we can appreciate what is going on. Now keep in mind that Gideon and his men are on the Transjordan side coming from the north southward. So they're chasing the Midianites that are still fleeing. And so look at verse 4. Then Gideon and the 300 men who were with him came to the Jordan and crossed over, weary yet pursuing. He said to the men of Succoth, "Please give loaves of bread to the people who are following me, for they are weary, and I am pursuing Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian." So here are two more kings of the Midianite tribes that are still left. Now look at verse 6. The leaders of Succoth said, "Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army?" Okay, now I want you to look carefully at that, and let me just make sure everyone appreciates what's happening. This is the city of Succoth, just on the north side of the Jabbok River, close to the Jordan. And what is said here, and the incident that happens there, where Gideon asked the men of Succoth for assistance, you know, provisions, and they refuse, that same thing is going to happen when he then comes to the city of Penuel, just a little bit further west. And they're going to refuse to assist Gideon and his men too. Look at the reason that they give. Verse 6, the leaders of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hands that we should give bread to your army? What do they mean by that, and what are they concerned about? Okay. We're not sure yet whether you're really going to be the ultimate victor here. We're trying to play our cards right here and make sure we're on the winning side, and we're not sure that it's going to be you. Now, what do you think about that? What's your comment about their refusal to help Gideon because they're not confident that he's really going to be the victor in all this? They're opportunists, okay.
Seems like they haven't seen or understood exactly what they've done so far with just 300 men. God is on their side, and they're not trusting in God that he's going to give them victory.
Okay, isn't there a religious issue in this? Does everybody really appreciate here the religious element in this entire battle between the sons of Israel, led by this particular man Gideon, and the people of Midian? This is not just some secular battle here, and you know which army's going to win here. This is a war that has religious overtones. Because the whole issue here is whose God really is God. Is it the God Yahweh that Gideon is serving, or is it the God of the Midianites? And who was the God of the Midianites? All right, Baal. They are worshiping Baal, who is the head god of the pantheon of gods who are viewed as being the deities of this territory, this whole Levant region that Canaan is a part of. And so the whole issue here is really an issue of, is Yahweh truly God, or is Baal? Okay, now let's go back to this whole issue of Gideon and him being the particular individual who is leading the Israelite armies. What's Gideon's other name? Jerubbaal, which means what? You recall what we said last time? Let Baal contend. And why was he given that additional name? What's the point of that? He had desecrated the altar of Baal that was on his father's property. And he did that in the name of Yahweh. And his father had even stepped in and prevented the people from killing him by arguing, if he's desecrated the altar of Baal, well then the god Baal should be the one who should be offended and should strike out at my son. So let Baal contend. And he gave him that name. Yerubbaal is how you'd say that in Hebrew. It means let Baal contend. And so does everyone appreciate then this whole time Gideon, in the name of Yahweh, is fighting against the Midianites under the title of let Baal contend with me if he really is God and I'm somehow dishonoring Baal? But of course the whole point is my God is Yahweh and I'm on his side. Does everyone appreciate the significance of that? So here they have been having a tremendous victory against the Midianites at this point. And, you know, Baal sure hasn't been contending too much. He hadn't been able to do too much to prevent Gideon, Jerubbaal, from defeating all these worshipers of Baal from Midian. And so here are the men now of Succoth and Penuel who are saying, Well, you haven't fully captured all of the enemies here. You haven't captured all the leaders of the Midianites, so this war isn't necessarily over yet. And so we don't want to give you provisions because that makes us side with Yahweh against Baal. And we don't want any repercussions if it turns out that we've sided with the wrong horse. Okay, I've used about all the little metaphors I think I can come up with, you know, as anachronistic as they are. But that's what's going on here. And you really have to appreciate all of that. And if you don't, then I think you're going to come away and think, well, you know, Gideon is just a terrible leader here because he just really got angry and upset for no good reason. Did he have a good reason to be upset with the men of these two cities? Absolutely right. Because they are committing sacrilege against Yahweh. They are not serving Yahweh. And now that Gideon, in the name of Yahweh, is defeating the Midianites, they are, in essence, just showing their true colors. And it's a horrible, horrible insult to Yahweh that they're not helping Gideon. Okay? So what does he say? Well, or what finally happens here? I'm not going to take time to read all these verses, but when you go down to these verses, what finally happens as you go down through verse 17? He ultimately captures those last Midianite kings. The battle against Midian is won by Israel, and we should say Yahweh. And so he comes back to those two cities, and now he's going to make them eat their words. But this is not just some, you know, personal thing or whatever. This is a serious offense against Yahweh that they have committed. So I want you to look at this. Skip down to, what verse am I wanting here? Where he punishes them, disciplines. Oh, yes. Skip down to verse 15. Well, no, let's just start with verse 13. Then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heres, and he captured a youth from Succoth and questioned him. Then the youth wrote down for him the princes of Succoth and its elders, 77 men. That's pretty interesting. Excuse me, son. Okay, now I want you to tell me all the leaders of your city. Just give me their names. Just write them down. Kids are going to be very honest. They know who the leaders are. Okay. 77 men. He came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, concerning whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your men who are weary?'" Verse 16, he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars. And my version, the New American Standard Version, renders it like this: and he disciplined the men of Succoth with them. He tore down the tower of Penuel and killed the men of the city. Does anybody have a version that reads a little bit differently in verse 16, the last clause? And he taught the men of Succoth. That's another less than literal way of rendering it. Literally what the Hebrew says, he caused them to know the briars and the thistles. Hebrew is a very picturesque language. It's a language of very few words. You know, in English, we have dictionaries that are that thick. You know, our vocabulary in English is just profound. But Hebrew was a language of really very few words. But those words could be used in highly figurative senses. And so depending upon the context, that's how you know what is being said. So literally what it says is he caused them to know. In fact, literally the way it's worded in Hebrew is the thorns and the briars, he caused the men to know them. And I think they got acquainted real good. Now, of course, our versions render it, a little bit loosely, but still to make the point, he disciplined them or he taught them is maybe a little mild. But, okay. I mean, that's really stating the idea. But there are several commentators that to me just miss the whole point of this, and they talk about Gideon showing himself to be an evil man here, or a man of the times, and he's cruel, and he just without any provocation, he just tortures these men, and that misses the whole point. This is an act of judgment from Yahweh upon the men of Israel who have committed apostasy and have sided with Baal. That's the whole thing that's going on here. That's the reason why the Midianites are being destroyed. It's not because Israel's being cruel. It's because Israel is the arm of Yahweh's judgment. And that's what's going on. And so if the Midianites who have forsaken Yahweh are worthy of death, well then certainly the sons of Israel who have insulted Yahweh and have sided with Baal and sided with the Midianites and not taken a stand with Yahweh, they are deserving of this kind of punishment. And so that's what happens here to the men of Succoth and Penuel. Comments, questions about that, Bob?
Back up in verse 7. He predicted.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Right. I am coming back. Yeah. And that's exactly what happens here. This is what the book of Judges is trying to teach us here. During this era, the Israelites, the whole issue is whether or not, in fact, I think this is the best way to put it. The whole issue is whether or not Israel is going to just become acculturated into Canaanite culture and just become Canaanites. Or are they really going to be the sons of Israel with their Israelite culture as the law of Moses was establishing for them? The law of Moses was creating a culture of people who were worshipers of Yahweh in a particular way. And the Israelites during the Judges era are forsaking Yahweh and forsaking the law of Moses and forsaking Yahweh's culture that he was establishing for them. And they're just becoming acculturated into Canaanite culture. And that's the issue here. And this will be the issue all the way through the book of Judges. It will be the issue all the way up until the time of Samuel and finally David. Okay? Ralph?
Well, you said that these Israelites,
Succoth and Penuel?
Those were Israelite cities?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wasn't sure if that was going to be people who had already been in the land or if it was Israelites who were taken over that particular.
Now, these cities are Israelite cities in these Transjordan territories here of Gad and as you're going up into Manasseh. Those are Israelite cities. Now, are there a lot of Canaanites living throughout those territories still? Yeah. Hence, that's why it's so easy for these Israelites, even in these cities, to really become Canaanite and just adopt Canaanite ways. But they are Israelites, and that's the reason why he goes to them and asks for help. And that's why it was so serious when they said no. Okay, other comments or questions about this? Okay. All right, let's look at the next thing that happens here. Of course, he executes the Midianite kings, chapter 8, verses 18 through 21. And let's go ahead and just look at that. I think there are some things there that are especially interesting here. Then he said to Zeba and Zalmunna, "What kind of men were they whom you killed at Tabor?" Meaning back at Mount Tabor, just north of the Jezreel Valley. And they said, "They were like you, each one resembling the son of a king." He said, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother. As the Lord lives, if only you had let them live, I would not kill you." So he said to Jether, his firstborn, "Rise, kill them." But the youth did not draw his sword, for he was afraid, because he was still a youth. Then Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise up yourself and fall on us, for as the man, so is his strength." So Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna and took the crescent ornaments which were on their camels' necks.
Why did Gideon slay these two kings?
Judgment from Yahweh. I mean, that's the whole point of this. Okay. Why did he ask his son, his eldest son, to slay them initially? Yeah, what do you think would be the impression of that? I mean, that's, you know, to have a lesser individual, you know, commit the execution is a slap at them. But what else is he trying to do in reference to his son? You know, folks, I really think that this is one reason why it's so important for us to study the Old Testament. There are so many people in the denominational world who have so bought into this idea that, well, the God of the Old Testament is a God of judgment, but then in the New Testament era, suddenly he just totally changes his personality, and he's a God of grace and love, and there's been such a move to that extreme that the whole idea of judgment and the need for judgment has just been minimized. And, you know, this reminds me of when Moses came down from Mount Sinai and the Israelites had committed apostasy and broken the Mosaic covenant and were bowing down to the golden calf right there at the base of Yahweh's mountain. And when Moses comes down and he smashes the tablets to symbolize they had broken the covenant, what then did he do? Or what did he call upon the Levites to do? Do you recall that? He said, "You each take a sword in your hand and you march straight ahead of that mass of Israelites there and you slay everybody who's right in front of you." Why did he call upon the Levites to do that? Because that's how God was going to judge. And judgment was absolutely necessary. Now that's not to say there aren't occasions when Yahweh is merciful. But you know what, folks? If you negate judgment, if you so water down judgment, then at the same time you've minimized mercy and its value when God does extend it. And so here are occasions where Yahweh's patience had run out and the time had come for judgment upon the Canaanites. That's why he was sending the Israelites in at that point in human history, because the iniquity of the Amorite was now full. And now it was time for that whole Canaanite Baal-worshipping culture to be eradicated from the earth. And the Israelites are his arm of judgment. And when we get to the point where we are too weak or too, quote, righteous, too, quote, good, to approve of God's judgment, then we're really not on Yahweh's side. And that's a tough lesson for us, but we need to really appreciate that. What do we think hell is for? You know, God didn't create hell because he's mean. He created hell because it was a necessary place of judgment for the devil and his angels, and then for human beings who follow after them. So, you know, this is what's going on in the temporal realm, is a temporal judgment. And now the text makes it clear that Gideon's eldest son, since he was a youth, he just couldn't do this. And I think we can understand that. But Gideon shows him a lesson. And this will not be the only time as we go through the historical narrative. There will come a time, here as we get in the book of Samuel, where Samuel the prophet is going to teach the same lesson to King Saul. And Samuel's going to take care of judgment that Saul should have taken care of. So I'm just making those points because I think it's really crucial that we get what's going on here in the book of Judges and we learn the lesson of the book of Judges. Comments about that? Questions? Isaac?
Just a question of the ornaments around the camel's necks. Is there anything in these crescent? Was there anything that made the crescent too
tall? I don't know about that. Exactly what the significance of those ornaments are, other than the fact that that same kind of ornament, I understand, is found among people of that particular part of the world even centuries later. So it has some significance. I think it's a sign of great wealth, you know, and but I'm not sure exactly. I mean, is that a reference to the moon, or something like that? I don't know. I haven't read anything that explains that. Maybe we don't really know that. That's a great question, though. Okay, let's kind of hurry along here. All right. Now we're talking especially about Gideon's leadership, and I think it's so crucial to appreciate what happens in verses 22 and 23. The text says, "Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son, also your son's son, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. We want you to be our king and to establish a dynasty of kings in your name.'" Now that would be a tremendous honor for this man. Look at what he says. "But Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you.'" What's he mean by that? Okay, yeah, and the same issue, of course, will come up when we get to the book of Samuel, where the whole nation then just demands a king so they can be like the nations. But Yahweh's point then, and the point Gideon makes now, is, hey, the law of Moses makes it very clear. Yahweh is our king. And if there's going to be any human king, sort of a human co-regent, Yahweh needs to appoint him. It's not for us to presume to make ourselves king. And of course, Yahweh had not indicated that about Gideon. He turns this down flat and he says, "Your request, in effect, is an affront to Yahweh and his rulership over us. And so Yahweh is our king, and you're not going to make me king, nor shall my son, nor shall any of my sons be king." Now let me emphasize that point, because when we get to the next chapter, guess what? One of Gideon's sons tries to become king, and does for a while. But we'll talk about Abimelech Sunday. But again, this just shows you, I think, the quality of the man here. Now, having said all of that, in verses 24 and 27, there are some things that happen next that maybe you could fault him for. Though he refuses the kingship, he does request from them a pretty large monetary compensation, which they give him readily. And, he lives the rest of his days pretty well off as a result of all that. But it also talks about, and we don't have time to read the verses right now, I need to hurry along with this, but it also talks about how he makes an ephod. And the word ephod, it's a little hard to understand exactly how it's being intended in this context. In the Law of Moses system, do you recall who wore an ephod? The priest. And that was this outer, ornate vestment. And
The word here is apparently referring to some outer garment that was very ornate. Doesn't necessarily mean that it was of a priestly nature. I mean, I don't think we should think that Gideon was somehow trying to claim that he's a priest or something. But it's a very ornate, kind of special outer garment, outer vestment here. And, very, very wealthy and just, puts him in this special class. Now, whether he should have asked for that and done that or not, at least we know this. After he dies, when the nation departs from Yahweh, what do they begin to do with that ephod? They begin to worship it, and to me it reminds me of what a lot of religious people, even so-called Christianity, have done with relics. This is supposedly the tomb where Jesus was buried, and so people bow down and basically worship it, or this is supposed to be some wood from the cross of Jesus, and it becomes a sacred relic, and that's what kind of reminds me, or that's what this reminds me of. And they turn then this ephod into some kind of a religious relic, whether it's that they're elevating Gideon almost as if he is divine, after he dies, or just that somehow this whole thing, it becomes a relic that is not what the law of Moses ever said. And that becomes a stumbling block to the people of that next generation. So, I don't think Gideon at all was intending that, but unfortunately sometimes the decisions that we make in our lifetime, people in the next generation are going to take it and run with it in a direction that we never purposed. So, comments or questions about any of this with Gideon? Okay, we'll go ahead and stop there. And next time, get into chapter 9 and Abimelech.